Today on Against the Grain, the climate crisis no longer looms in the future, but has arrived in the form of deadly heat waves, enormous floods and wildfires, hurricanes and droughts. It's clear that, along with fighting to slow climate change, we also need to protect ourselves and the most vulnerable around us from the devastating effects of global warming, especially as the Trump administration slashes existing safeguards. Science writer and broadcaster David Pogue discusses what we can do in an increasingly precarious world. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. While the Trump administration dismantles checks on fossil fuel emissions and says it plans to eliminate FEMA by December, last month, Central Texas was hit by the most deadly flash flood in nearly half a century. Collective action remains paramount, but it's clear that we also need to prepare ourselves adequately for climate-fueled disasters. In his book, How to Prepare for Climate Change, A Practical Guide for Surviving the Chaos, David Pogue enumerates concrete ways we can protect ourselves. Pogue is a six-time Emmy Award winner, was the New York Times Weekly Tech columnist, is the author of dozens of books, and has been the host of multiple science specials on PBS. Here's an earlier conversation that I had with him.
The headline events are the wildfires and the heat waves this summer, three continents being baked by heat waves, drought and devastating rains and flooding and sea level rise and ticks and mosquitoes. They're just waiting for the next news cycle.
So wherever we live in the world, we're seeing the effects of climate change around us. But you point out that we're not all experiencing it equally, that if you're poor, you're way more likely to experience the worst effects of a climate disaster. Why is that? Why is it too glib to say that disasters are the great equalizer?
It is true that poorer areas, communities of color get hit first and worst by climate change. There's a long list of reasons why. But basically, it boils down to metropolitan geography. So poorer communities were traditionally redlined into less desirable areas of the cities. They tend to be in industrial areas where there's a lot of pavement and a lot of pollution. Often it is in low-lying areas right by the water. So they get the hurricanes and the sea level rise worst.
Well, let's talk and start with heat and heat waves. I mean, there are many different kinds of climate disasters, but the heat waves, which are scorching much of the United States and the world right now, heat kills more people than any other disaster in the US, more than flooding or wildfires or hurricanes. Can you tell us why that is?
All of those things combined, by the way. Heat is the biggest killer by an enormous, enormous margin. Part of it is because we're not really aware of what's happening inside our bodies. You know, a rainstorm you can see, rising sea levels you can see, you can take shelter. But people who work outside and athletes and even student athletes, the heat stroke and heat cramps, the things that happen to you, they creep up on you. You feel a little dizzy, you feel a little nauseous, you get a headache, but you just think, drink more water and I'll be fine. But it can be a lot worse. And most of these climate health effects strike very young people and very old people and ill people more frequently, of course. And that is especially true with heat. There's another weird thing I discovered in researching the book, which is that heat affects medicine. It literally changes the chemical bonds in the molecules of our medicines, and it can really turn your medicine into worthlessness, and it can actually change the chemical effects. So especially if you keep your medicine, let's say, on the top of the fridge where heat rises from the fridge and goes right into them, or even in the bathroom medicine cabinet, every time you take a shower, That's heat. So that's another reason that older people and sick people tend to get nailed by heat.
I was interested to learn from your book that part of the way that heat affects people is that it makes their hearts work overtime. Can you just talk about the way that as one gets hotter and hotter, our bodies struggle more and more to keep up, and at a certain point it may just be not enough?
Yeah, so you have two ways to shed heat. First of all, there's radiant heat, you know, just heat coming off your skin as it would cool down any object. And the problem with that is that when the outdoor air is hotter than your skin is, there's nowhere for the heat to go. It no longer leaves your skin. And the second way you shed heat is through perspiration. It turns out that any surface, including your skin, cools down as water evaporates off of it. And that is why humidity is such a nightmare, because when the air around us is humid, that means it's already full of evaporated water. And the water on your skin, your sweat, no longer evaporates. So in a heat wave, both of the mechanisms you have to cool down fail. So your heart says, whoa, what's going on? Must be I'm not pumping enough blood close to the surface of the skin to let it cool. Let's go. And your heart starts pumping harder and harder. When it's really hot out, your heart can pump 4 times the usual volume of blood through your body just in an effort to let its heat radiate off. After a certain point during a heat wave, of course, all of that fails, and pretty soon your body just can no longer regulate its own temperature. And that's when these things start happening. The two signs, one is heat exhaustion, and that's if your skin is clammy and hot. And then the really scary one is when your skin gets dry and cold to the touch. That is heat stroke, and that is what will kill you. So that means go to the hospital, get water on your body, take off as many clothes as you can, put something cold under your neck and under your armpits. That's when you have to physically cold your body down in a hurry.
Well, before one gets to that sort of critical stage, hopefully, how should we prepare ourselves for heat waves, especially when a common response is turning on the air conditioner, which, of course, contributes to a warming planet?
It does. I mean, don't get me started on the air conditioning problem. It's this perpetual cycle. We think, oh, AC is the solution to the heat waves. But of course, all those air conditioners running, number one, contributes to emissions because they're the most energy intensive things we own. So they produce more emissions that makes the climate change problem worse. And they also work by shunting heat from your house outdoors. It pumps heat from indoors to outdoors, which literally raises the temperature of the city by another couple of degrees, all those air conditioners running at once. Also important to remember that many cities were not designed for heat, San Francisco being one of them. So every time San Francisco gets hit by a heat wave, you know, in 2017 or 2021, it was, you know, 106, you go to Best Buy to get an air conditioner and they're sold out. You know, you're not the first person to think of that. I mean, San Francisco was never intended to be an air conditioned city, but it is becoming one.
And yet you write that as the temperature rises and in a heat wave, that if we get beyond a certain temperature, I believe it's 95 degrees Fahrenheit, that having a fan blow on you, which is a much more energy efficient way of generating a cooling effect, that actually after a certain point, a fan is not going to cut it. So what should we do under those circumstances? And of course, because of the dynamics you've just described of a lot of people turning on the air conditioner at once in a heat wave, it often leads to blackouts as well. That may not even be an option after a certain point. So once the temperature has gotten to a point where you really need to take some kind of action to bring it down, how can you do it that is not reliant on a fan or even an air conditioner.
Yeah, it's true about the fans. It works by blowing the sweat off of your skin, so you get that effect we described earlier working. But it is not lowering the temperature of the room, so you do have to be a little bit careful. You know, there are a whole bunch of sort of hacks that can help you remain cool, and especially to sleep. Trying to sleep in the heat is just a miserable experience, but there are some really cool things you can do. First of all, heat rises. So the lower you can go in your house, I mean, if you have a basement, you're golden because dirt is a great insulator and the ground is 55 degrees all year round. So if you have a basement, that's always a nice, cool place to ride out the heat wave. There's an old trick where you get your sheets wet and then you wring them out until they're just damp. And man, if you put that on your body, you will not be too hot. It's really nice. There are some tricks you can do with your house involving the windows. For example, if your windows open at both the bottom and the top, you do both of those. Hot air will rise up and go out the top opening, and that will cause a suction effect to bring cool air in the bottom of the window. Of course, most people can figure out to set up a cross breeze through the house, shoving out the stagnant air if you can do that. And even, you know, if your bathroom has an exhaust fan or the kitchen has a hood or a vent, they're there to blow air, to move air through your house, and they will also help with getting air moving.
One of the constants that seems to run through preparedness for all sorts of disasters is having adequate water. And obviously, in a heat wave, you need to be hydrated. How much water generally do you think people should store in anticipation of any kind of disaster?
The water thing is really becoming an issue in a couple of ways. One is, as you say, what if the metropolitan water supply gets contaminated? And that's a question of, you know, do you run to the store and buy bottled water? But, you know, I like to point out that there is clean drinkable water already within the walls of your home. So you don't necessarily need to run out and buy plastic water bottles. For example, in your hot water heater, that's 40 gallons of clean chlorinated water ready to go right there. In a pinch, you can shut off the heat, open the valve at the top, and then open the valve at the bottom and pour yourself water. There's also water in your toilets. I don't mean that you should drink from the bowl, unless you're a Labrador. I mean the tank on the back. That is, believe it or not, clean, uncontaminated water. And there's, you know, a couple gallons in every toilet you've got. And then at some point, you know, we should also talk about the bigger water picture of, like, where we get our drinking water. Because that's something else you don't see much on the news, because it's not very telegenic. There's not much fun pointing your camera at a brown, dead field as opposed to a wildfire, let's say, but it's becoming a real problem.
I was amazed to read, speaking of that larger question of where we get our water, especially in a climate that is beset more frequently with drought, that 41% of our fresh water is used to cool power plants. That was astounding.
I know. It's crazy. And if you tell somebody from, you know, a less affluent country, that we flush our toilets and water our lawns and cool our power plants with treated, fluoridated, chlorinated, purified water, they'll think you're crazy. I mean, what we really need is two different water systems, one for water that we drink, and then, you know, gray water that we can water our gardens with and flush our toilets with. But anyway, yeah, we really treat water as though it's a free commodity.
I'm speaking with science writer and broadcaster David Pogue about his book, How to Prepare for Climate Change, A Practical Guide for Surviving the Chaos. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So let's turn to the opposite of drought, to flooding. Flooding kills more people worldwide than any other weather disaster. and it's the most destructive type of disaster in the United States. There are different kinds of flooding from different sources, but can you start with coastal areas? How at risk are they for increased flooding now and into the future?
Well, the sea level rise thing is the biggie. In fact, the oceans really are the problem with the climate crisis, because all this heat that the planet has absorbed goes primarily into the oceans. 93% of it is stored in the oceans. And what that does is it triggers more evaporation from the oceans. I don't know if you remember your water cycle from elementary school, but more evaporation means more moisture in the air, and that means more rain, and that means bigger hurricanes, that means more lightning, all kinds of things result. And in the longer scale, it's important to remember that even if we stop burning fossil fuels tomorrow, which we won't, but even if we did, it takes a long time for the oceans to change temperature, like a generation or two. So a lot of people ask me when I give talks, you know, how can we reverse this? Is it too late? And, you know, it's not going to get back to the weather of the 1980s, let's say, in your lifetime. So in that regard, it's done. You know, right now, the goal is to stop it from getting a lot worse. But yeah, flooding on the coast is an obvious one. Our policies have not been designed to discourage people from building in floodplains until very recently. The insurance companies do not cover flooding. You can look at your home policy. Flooding is not covered, I hate to tell you. Theft, fire, sure, but not flooding. So all the insurance companies got out of the business because they realized it's impossible to make money insuring people for flood. And so in the 70s, the government stepped in and said, tell you what, we will get into the insurance business ourselves and provide people with flood insurance. 95% of all flood insurance today is provided by the government. So they finally raised the rates to match reality. And we'll see how that goes. But yeah, so we have not designed insurances or policies to reflect the dangers of living on the coast.
Of course, a lot of the private insurers are more and more wary about insuring for disasters, and that is one of the parts of this larger picture of people no longer getting insurance. But just staying with flooding for now, so you mentioned flooding on the coast, and of course, if anyone sees sea level rise maps, they're frightening on both coasts. But we're also witnessing that flooding is getting worse in places not close to the coast, and, you know, places that haven't traditionally flooded, like Vermont. What drives those floods?
Oh, man. This blew my mind. It turns out that of the 10 most flooded states in the United States, as measured by national flood emergency declarations, 8 of them are inland. 8 of them are not coastal states. In fact, the number one most flooded state is Arkansas. It's like, what? And it's because in the climate crisis era, we alternate these periods of extreme drought and dryness, which dries out the ground and makes it hard, followed by devastating, merciless rains. And now the water has nowhere to go. It doesn't soak into the earth. So it sort of runs down the hills into our streets and our basements and our businesses and floods us. So it's that kind of cycle that we were not designed to handle. And that's why these inland states are getting more flooded than coastal states are.
Well, how should we prepare for flooding? Obviously, as you say, there are all sorts of houses and buildings that have been constructed in floodplains. And yet, now it appears that even if you're not in places in a floodplain or a place that traditionally is flooded, you should prepare for being flooded because it can happen anywhere. So what sort of preparations would you recommend people take? Now, some, of course, are homeowners. Other people live in apartments. What sort of measures should people take?
I mean, eventually, we are going to have to stop pretending that climate change is just an occasional nuisance. And I think that's a slow, awful realization for a lot of people. And what I mean by that is, you know, the experts who are looking a couple of years ahead are saying we're going to have to sacrifice land to nature. We're going to have to give up areas where we have traditionally built. And, you know, that we're talking about, you know, New Orleans and southern Texas and some of the areas on the Gulf that continually get flooded, continually get devastating hurricanes. There's a lot of thought that maybe it's just not worth rebuilding over and over. Maybe we should buy those people out and abandon their homes to the ravages of nature. And that's starting to happen. FEMA is already buying up tens of thousands of homes because it's cheaper to do that than to keep reimbursing these people to rebuild after their homes are destroyed. And here in California, we're going to have to start thinking about, you know, homes that we're building in the, you know, woodland civilization interface areas where we're building homes right up against wildfire territory. It's beautiful, but it's not safe. You know, those houses are sitting ducks for fire. And so with flooding, it's that same thing. You know, number one, on a societal level, should we start thinking about not building where we've been building? And then as a homeowner, there are, of course, a few things you can do. One of them that's not too expensive is to raise your electrical panel out of the way of flooding things. I mean, there are, of course, various basement systems you can install. I kind of hate the question because one of the goals of this book was not to make it a handbook for rich people to escape the ravages of the climate change. You know, most of the suggestions in it are free and just a matter of being thoughtful and smart rather than buying stuff or paying for stuff. But in some cases, like if you live in a house that's getting flooded, you don't have a lot of free options except to keep it in mind and get stuff up off the floor.
So you've just said some of what we should do in preparation for a flood. What should we not do when it floods?
Well, you might think this is obvious, but you will not believe the number of people who die every year driving across floodwaters, like even a flooded intersection. You know, typically the authorities will put up yellow tape or put up signs, do not drive through floodwaters. And every year people do it. There's a bunch of reasons that's a terrible idea. One is that you just can't see what's under there. You don't know how deep it is, how fast the water is moving, or whatever is under there, you know, rocks and wires and rebar. The water is also probably contaminated, you know, sewage and oil and fertilizer and gross stuff. So you don't want to get near floodwaters. You don't want your kids near floodwaters, and you definitely do not want to drive through floodwaters, which people do every year anyway. It's a bad idea. I mean, people get swept away. You know, your car will float and literally off you go. The tires act like rafts, and you know, only 18 inches of water can lift an SUV. So it's not safe.
What should you do in the aftermath of a flood? I mean, obviously the pictures of people going out in their bathing suit in what is highly contaminated, disgusting water is not a good call. But in the wake of a flood, one is often left with a moldy mess. What do you recommend at that point after the waters have receded or when they're starting to recede, when the moment of inundation has ended? What should people do?
Mercifully, this won't happen to a lot of people, but when you do come back to your house after a flood, I mean, it's just a death trap. I mean, the walls and the floors and the ceilings are weakened. They can collapse without warning. If you turn on the gas or the power that without having had it checked out by an electrician, you know, it can start a fire, it can blow up. Gas leaks are very common after a flood disaster. Power lines are down. Your appliances have gotten wet. They will electrocute you. So it's just generally a mess. The first people you want to get there are the insurance adjuster and an electrician to scope things out to make sure it's safe to go in there. And then, then comes the cleaning process. Anything wet more than 24 hours is going to be risk of mold, which is an awful nightmare you really don't want to deal with. You wind up throwing away anything soft, you know, curtains, clothes, couches. And remember, your food in the fridge, if the power's gone out, it may not be safe. They say to throw anything away that's been unrefrigerated for 24 hours. So it's a tough time.
Let's switch to another horrible disaster, wildfires. Obviously, residents of the West have been experiencing increasing and increasingly destructive wildfires for a number of years now. While much of the East Coast has been insulated from it, until these enormous fires in Canada have inundated the Midwest and East Coast with toxic smoke, you know, some of it coming all the way from Western Canada. And politicians in those areas and those in charge really, in many cases, don't have a sense of even what to do or how to convey the danger to people of that kind of smoke. Can you just remind us why we should avoid breathing in that kind of smoke and what sort of measures can be taken to not inhale the smoke that comes from these terrible fires?
Yeah, I mean, when there's a wildfire, it's more than trees that are burning. It's all kinds of, you know, it's cars, it's homes, it's buildings, it's tractors, it's stuff that was never intended to be burned. And with that, they've measured thousands of compounds in wildfire smoke that are heavy metals and other toxins that are just really bad for you. So if there is any way not to be outside breathing wildfire smoke, you should take advantage of that. In some ways, talking about these individual disasters, you know, flood and fire and heat wave and coastal sea level rise, is missing the larger point, which is that they are all one elaborate system. You know, nature and weather are interconnected in thousands of ways. You know, you get more wildfires because the ground is hotter and drier, and the world is hotter and drier because we're burning more combustible oil and coal to blanket the earth more. So there are these domino effects, and some of them are weird, and, you know, smaller beaches and more expensive chocolate and lower PSAT scores and smaller goats. I mean, there are these second and tertiary effects, but it's all connected. So, and it all comes back to the one golden rule, which is we got to stop burning stuff. To the extent that our politicians and the oil lobby will let us. But that's, I mean, just remember that wildfire is not a thing unto itself. It's just part of this elaborate system where everything affects everything else.
Right. And to that point, many of these disasters are showing up, as you've just said, as multiple disasters. And so recent studies have shown that experiencing smoke and heat simultaneously, which often people do, that it has a kind of multiplier effect, making the deleterious consequences of both smoke inhalation and heat exposure worse.
Yeah, for sure. And we also need to start thinking long-term. As the world heats up, there are already areas that are becoming uninhabitable. You know, southern, hot, dry areas of the world where you can't farm anymore, you can't raise food, people are going to start leaving en masse. You know, the UN expects it'll be 200 million people a year within a few years moving north into more livable areas. And that means people from Central America moving up into North America. And of course, more people moving up into out of the African hotter areas into Europe and so on. And so we really need to start thinking in the big picture about where are we going to live on this planet and how are we going to support more people living in smaller spaces. I mean, it's smaller amounts of space. I think it's just pretty much inevitable, and it's already starting to take place.
Are you seeing that within the U.S. itself? I mean, if you look at a climate map, you'll see that all parts of the country are going to be affected badly by an increased climate, but there are some places that will be especially badly hit, the coast, the south, and there are some places that will have more fresh water and will certainly be affected, but somewhat less.
I mean, obviously, not everybody has the opportunity to move, especially on the basis of climate, but 40 million people in America do move every year for other reasons, you know, for a job, because they're getting married or divorced or graduating or getting out of the military, whatever it is. And increasingly, where they can go should be a criterion as they make their decision. You're right, there's no place in the U.S. that is free from climate disasters. But if you have a choice, I mean, think about it. The West Coast has wildfire and a drought, and you know, the Pacific Northwest has these massive beetle infestations. The East Coast has the hurricanes and the heat waves. The South has, you know, hurricanes and heat waves. The entire West and South are both having serious drinking water issues. So where does that leave you? Basically, the Great Lakes area is kind of the climate sweet spot. They don't have hurricanes. They don't have severe heat waves. They don't have drought. They've got the Great Lakes right there. So right now, all those great Rust Belt cities are looking forward. Literally, the city mothers and fathers are marketing themselves as climate havens. You know, Cleveland and Madison and Duluth and Buffalo. All these former industrial towns are now perfectly positioned to ride out the next 100 years in relative calm compared to the rest of the country.
Well, as you say, there's limited capacity, right, for any one place to absorb all the people who might need to move. And inevitably, you know, many, many people can't move. They can't afford to move. They have roots in a place. And so figuring out how they can remain where they are while trying to offset their risk or at least prepare. And what you're not arguing is that we all go into our bunkers and deal with this individually, that we also need to be dealing with it collectively and politically. But staying with the kind of precautions that people can take, now obviously some of them vary depending on the region and what kind of danger they face. Wildfires are different than the precautions that you might take to do with floods, although some of them also might overlap. Some parts of the country are prone to hurricanes, some parts to tornadoes, some parts to drought, and of course, many parts to, you know, multiple things. But are there some overarching recommendations that you would make for preparedness that people should make sure to do rather than sort of hoping that these things won't show up at their door?
Yeah, I think the big one is recognize that these freak weather events aren't freak weather events anymore. I mean, this is normal. I interviewed one of the executives from Cal Fire a couple of years ago after those brutal fires that took down Paradise and so on. And the season was just ending. And I said, wow, you must be so glad that year of historic, worst recorded wildfires in California history is over. And he said, what are you talking about? Like, to us, that's the new baseline. That season we've just had, that's zero for what's to come. You know, the next 10 years are going to be much worse. And so once you recognize that these things are the norm and not oddities anymore, there are certain ways you can reframe your thinking. Like, one of the things that really distresses me about the California fires and the hurricanes and the rest of the country is when people die because they didn't get the alert. They didn't find out that they had to evacuate. And so one of the things that I advise people is to download this free app. It's just called Emergency. It's from the American Red Cross. And it's really cool. It lets you put in your address and the address of your parents or anyone else you care about, wherever they live in the country. And then you can kind of put it away in a folder on your phone somewhere. If any one of 50 different disasters approaches that address, whether it's these climate disasters or even a man-made thing like, you know, nuclear event or a chemical spill, it will come to life and chirp and chime and notify you so that you can get busy notifying that person. Another thing I think you should do is more and more, we are told to temporarily get out of our homes because of flooding, because of fire, because of air quality. And it's not, I mean, when things are calm, it's not out of the question for you to think, what would we do in that situation? I know here in California, a lot of people already know about go bags or bug out bags. This is a, you know, a backpack you keep in the front closet that has everything you would need to survive for a couple days out of the house. Snacks, water, first aid kit, copies of your ID, and some cash. Maybe your phone charging cable. And you just have that ready to go so that when they say, you got to evacuate now, you can do that and you won't be at the end of the long line of cars leaving town. And in a similar vein, I recommend that you sit down with your family some Saturday night and say, so guys, one common thing that happens in disasters is cell service goes out. What would we do if there was a disaster during the day when you kids were in school and I'm at work? How would we communicate? What would we do? Well, what you do is you figure out in advance a meeting place. You're like, okay, if there's some day and they've taped off the street and we're not allowed back to our house, we will meet at the Walmart or we will meet at the library, whatever it is. And everybody remembers that. You tape it on the fridge, you put it in your glove compartment, you put it on a note in everybody's phone, because 3 years from now, you'll have forgotten the conversation, but you'll have remembered that you had some place you agreed on. So there's certain things like that. Oh, and the last thing is, I know it's boring as hell, but look over your insurance policy. You probably got it a long time ago, looking to get it as cheaply as possible, and times have changed. I mean, the things you thought you were worried about are no longer the things you're worried about in terms of the changing climate. So I would review that insurance policy. When I did that, working on the book, I discovered that I was paying too much. I was paying for coverage I did not need. So it's a good idea to just review that declaration page, like the first page of your insurance policy, and like, are we covered?
You mentioned a moment ago children, and you write in your book about protecting children now, and that can be at multiple levels. Tell us how you think, on the one hand, adults should talk to children about these dangers because they can be very scary, and even anticipating them can be scary. And of course, the climate future is scary for them. And then also, if you could talk about the particulars of protecting children in a moment of crisis.
Yeah. You know, I guess my attitude with my three kids tends to be, let them have their childhood, let them live in ignorant bliss. No need to bring up climate disasters and the end of the world. But I interviewed five psychologists for the book, and they all told me that I'm wrong on that. Like, they know anyway. They're hearing it at school. They're hearing it from YouTube videos. They are already anxious about climate change. So the way to talk to them, of course, is dependent on their age. You want to be age appropriate. But, you know, in general, you have to acknowledge that disasters are happening, that there is some risk, because otherwise they're going to think you're lying and that they will imagine that things are much worse than they are. And then in terms of protecting them, I mean, you got to remember that they're immature physiologically. They're not developed. So they are much more prone to heat and air quality issues. They're more susceptible to insect-borne diseases. So, yeah, so you need to soothe them mentally with eco-despair conversations. You need to protect them physically, especially in hot weather. And then, you know, after disaster, there are a whole bunch of things you can do too. You want to restore whatever normalcy you can, whether it's just a matter of their schedule or one favorite toy. You want to gradually bring back, if you've been displaced from your house, for example, you want to bring back as many standard items that they used to know as you can until everything is back to normal.
What about protecting pets? Pets who might not be allowed to be taken if you're given an evacuation order. Pets who presumably could also be affected by heat waves and disasters, and like the rest of us, from increasing dangers from ticks and other things that are migrating north because the climate has changed.
Yeah, well, I think probably the most common one is dogs in the car. there's a big debate about whether or not you can leave a dog in the car while you run into the store. Obviously, the general advice is never, ever, ever, because this is funny, because in the book I note that I hate the term greenhouse effect, because most Americans have never been in a greenhouse, have no idea what greenhouse effect means, don't realize that it's 20 degrees hotter in a greenhouse than outside. I think dog in the car effect is much more illustrative. And it is, in fact, exactly what happens. You know, the sunshine comes in, heats up the upholstery, that gives off radiant heat, and it's trapped by the windows, and the interior of the car gets hotter and hotter and hotter. In many states, it's now legal to smash the window of a car with a dog inside, because so many animals die inside. You think you're going into the store just for a second, and you get in a conversation with an old friend, or you have to return the grapes or whatever, and next thing you know, your dog has died. But yeah, you have to think about your pet in any disaster. It depends on what the disaster is, but I think you should chip them, so if they get separated from you, they'll be able to find their way home. You can make a bug out bag for your pet. So what medicine, what food will the pet need if you have to leave suddenly? The SPCA offers these decals for free that you can put on your window of your home to let them know that there are animals inside. So if firefighters have to come, they'll know that it's not just the people that need rescuing. Again, it's mostly just about thinking ahead and imagining what would happen. Who could we leave the dog with if we have to evacuate for a couple weeks? You know, that's another question that you can answer just by thinking ahead.
What about gardening? Now, that would seem on some level like the least of anyone's problems, that those who have gardens, it's become much harder with the extremes of rain and drought and so on. Does gardening have a place in our disaster preparedness?
Of course. And, you know, in two ways. One is your garden can actually be a source of food when all hell is breaking loose. I mean, you can grow, you know, root vegetables and squash and broccoli and things, and then, you know, freeze them or put them up, meaning like dry them out or save them, peanuts and so on. And then, you know, the rest of the gardening chapter in my book is about how to grow your garden successfully beyond the survival garden idea. And, you know, every packet of seeds has this U.S. map on the back that the USDA prepares with these horizontal color bands that divide the country into regions where that packet of seeds will grow successfully. And because of climate change, those color bands are shifting upward. They're the growing regions are shifting northward as the earth hottens up from the center. And so it's really important to understand that stuff that used to grow fine are going to have more trouble growing these days. So you have to choose your crops more carefully. And also, you know, more and more you're going to need to worry about how you're going to water these things and how you're going to protect them from bugs and attract the right bugs. You know, there's a lot of discussion in gardening communities about the pollinator problem. These days, because it gets warm so much earlier in the spring than it used to, the blooms are coming out too early for the bees and the butterflies and the bats to come and pollinate. There's a mistiming now, and it's a real disaster. And the only thing you can do to prevent that is diversity. You plant a huge range of flowers and crops that will all bloom at different times. So, you know, when the pollinator bugs come along, if one thing isn't blooming, something else will. And of course, a big movement toward planting native plants, plants that are made to thrive where you live.
Sure, although if our horticultural zones are actually changing, does that also stress the native plants that thought they were, you know, zone 4 plants and now they're actually in a zone 5 situation?
Yes, you're right. It's all a matter of constant attention and research. I was amazed to discover, and of course gardeners are laughing at me because this is all so obvious to people who are really into gardening, but there were these land-grant universities that the government created around the country who then opened extension offices. These are agricultural resources all over the country. There's 100 of them across the United States where for free they will answer your questions. You can send them a picture of a bug that's eating your leaves and they'll tell you what to do about it. These are, you know, extension branches of these land-grant universities that exist taxpayer-funded to help you with your growing problems and your gardening issues, and they are so wonderful. So highly recommend you looking up the nearest one if you're having any trouble.
Well, you've mentioned bugs in the context of gardening. Now, the climate changes and the shift of weather patterns and heat have made more northern climes more hospitable to insects that lived further south. Can you describe some of those and why that's a concern?
Yeah, this is awful. This is awful. Ticks and Aedes aegypti, the most common mosquito, are that carry disease. These are moving northward as the winters get milder. So the winters aren't killing off the generations of these bugs like they used to. And so they're creeping north. They're finding ticks in Canada now, which never used to be the case. And along with that, you know, the numbers of cases of tick-borne and mosquito-borne diseases are skyrocketing. I mean, that's just a terrifying one because it's all but invisible. The tick, you know, Lyme disease, you really don't want to get that. It's so hard to diagnose. There's no good test for it. There's no good treatment for it once it's settled in. If you think you've been bitten by a tick, first of all, get antibiotics right away. That is the only known way to fend off Lyme disease. And like even once you have Lyme disease, it's got these vague symptoms that differ by person, very hard to pin down. But I did learn a whole bunch of really interesting things about ticks. You know, people say, oh, they sit up in the tree waiting for you to walk by and then they jump down on you. Well, no, they don't jump. They don't fly. They don't even have eyes. What they do is they sit on the ground or low-level plants with their little forelegs waving in the air until some critter like you walks by and then they grab onto you. Not all of them carry disease. And if they do carry disease, you can't get it until that tick has been attached to you for at least 24 hours. So that is a really great grace period. So bottom line is after you come back inside from a walk, take off your clothes, throw them in the dryer because ticks are also incredibly humidity dependent. Below 82% humidity, they just die. So toss your clothes in the dryer for 10 minutes. That kills anything that's on the clothes. And while you're standing there naked, you look over your hairy parts, see if there's anything stuck to you, and just pull it off with a pair of tweezers, and you're good to go.
David, I'd like to end by asking you how you see the need for people to come up with adequate prevention, protection, anticipating risks ahead, anticipating the inevitable, as you said, with these climate disasters, they're no longer freak occurrences, but something that we should expect over and over again. How to do that adequately as individuals without kind of falling into the mentality of right-wing preppers that we're going to hole ourselves up and fight against the world that might come in around us. How do you see that? Because you're making an argument that we should be adequately prepared. And in many ways, this is something we have to do ourselves, that we can't really rely on the government necessarily to prepare us. At the same time, how does that keep us from developing a bunker mentality?
Well, I mean, the bottom line is that this book, How to Prepare for Climate Change, is about personal adaptation. So adaptation used to be considered a dirty word in climate circles because the thing we're generally urged to do is called mitigation. And that means trying to stop climate change, you know, stop taking airplanes, stop eating red meat, take public transportation. And we do need to do all that. We should continue to do all that within an inch of our lives. But adaptation means coping with what's already here and accepting that there are new dangers that weren't there when we were growing up. Why shouldn't you protect yourself and your family, even though nobody's talking about it? The time is clearly here. Every time you realize about heat deaths or flooding deaths or hurricane deaths, and not just deaths, but sickness and your home getting destroyed, and it's costly, it's disruptive to your life. And when there are simple, cheap things that you can do, I get we didn't have this when we were kids. I get that it's upsetting. I get that it's a new reality. But at the same time, there are easy ways to protect yourself. And I think we need to bite the bullet, accept that things have changed, and take the steps we need to protect ourselves. You'll sleep better at night.
David Pogue, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with David Pogue, host of the podcast Unsung Science, and we've been discussing his book, How to Prepare for Climate Change, A Practical Guide for Surviving the Climate Chaos. And that's published by Simon & Schuster. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.